The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show EDU edition for this week. Sounds like Jim's got an idea that he wanted to talk about, or at least a timely article that prompted today's show. We'll let him fill in the blanks here, but article here in the Wall Street Journal regards to retirement seems to be something that is worthy of discussion here on this week's EDU show. So, Jim, we can dive right in unless you have...
We can.
Oh, actually, I do need to say something. I've gotten quite a few emails on this. Last week, We had this discussion about C.W. McCall. If you recall,
I do.
Where I mentioned that one of my favorite songs, actually off the album Everybody Loves Convoy, but I like Wolf Creek Pass instead. And I thought there were some lyrics to the effect of telephone poles going by looking like a picket fence. That was actually a song. And I started to doubt myself in that show, if you listen to that show. And I'm glad I was doubting myself, because it was not C.W. McCall that had that song. It was Hot Rod Lincoln by Commander Cody that has that phrase in it. So the Wolf Creek Pass song still talks about a truck out of control going really fast down the mountain. But the whole line about telephone poles looking like a picket fence, that's Hot Rod Lincoln.
You can tell this is all 1970s when Commander Cody... is singing about what again?
Hot Rod Lincoln.
Hot Rod Lincoln from Commander Cody in Wolf Creek Pass. That's just so 70s. Definitely. Is Commander Cody, by the way, related to Buffalo Bill?
What?
Buffalo Bill Cody. Cody, Wyoming?
I understand, but what does that have to do with a 1970s pop song?
Nothing, but maybe he was related to Buffalo Bill Cody because his name is Commander Cody.
I don't think so.
You never know. I mean, Cody's not a very common last name.
I think out west here it is.
Well, true, because you got Cody, Wyoming. But, all right, well, thank
Actually,
you for...
Actually, Commander Cody is a rock group, not a person.
Oh, well, then they won't be related to Buffalo Bill Cody. Okay. All right, well, these are the interesting little tidbits, folks, you get on the Retirement and IRA Show. This is the Q&A. No, it's not the Q&A. It's the EDU. We're going to dive a little deeper. It is an article that literally came out about 11 hours ago. I read first thing in the morning.
Now we got to go into this whole Commander Cody thing. It's actually Commander Cody and his Lost Planet Airmen.
Oh, that's 1970s for sure.
Rock band founded in 1967. But then, of course, they were playing through the 70s and... Got the, I'm trying to see when Hot Rod Lincoln came out. It was...
I don't think our listeners care.
Well, it was brought up on the show. We have to... First released in 1955. That's a much older song.
Much older song, yeah.
But yeah, it has that 70s vibe for sure.
All righty. Well, what else was brought up on the show? Since apparently Bugsy...
Oh, yeah.
It's not winning a lot of praise. Apparently, I'm not allowed to name or change the call signal given to me, but I disagree. We've received emails One, I know you got forwarded on one, and I received another. Not to call myself Bugsy, it's Bugs. The fighter pilot gave me the call sign Bugs.
Right.
But in his explanation of how fighter pilots get call signs, he did say the person can stand up. I guess literally, I don't know, stand up and explain why they would prefer a different name. So
yeah, but the rest of get to vote on it. So you don't just get to select it and then sit down and assume that it was accepted.
Well, who's voting on this?
Me. I'm the only one here.
Well, I get a vote too.
And I vote no.
And I vote yes.
No, you don't get a vote for your own thing.
Of course you do.
Oh my gosh.
The fighter pilot never said the person can't vote for himself.
If you're not going to embrace the whole call sign
it's just
situation.
Bugs. I do like Bugs Bunny, but Bugsy is more masculine. It's manly.
That's why you don't get to select it. You don't get to choose your own to make yourself sound more manly.
Well, okay, folks, I'm going to throw it out there to our listeners.
For a vote.
Can they vote?
I guess.
What's my call sign name? Chris is Cowboy, and it fits him to the T. He grew up in Wyoming. They're called the Cowboys. He, what was the other thing? Oh, you're trying to rein you in. Rein me in.
Yep. Kind of like herding cats.
And herding cats. You're reining me in. And you went to the University of Wyoming, whose little mascot there is a cowboy.
Little. What do you mean, little mascot? What is that? That's derogatory. He's full size. He's a full size cowboy.
Whatever. So cowboy,
and his name's Joe, just so you know.
Cowboy Joe. That's original. Wow, you people in Wyoming, you really go out on a limb there with your creative thinking. So anyways, folks, since this can go to a vote, I would like people to vote. Is my call sign Bugs or Bugsy?
And
keep in mind, as I prioritize emails.
Oh, stop.
To go on the show.
You can't put your thumb on the scales of justice like that.
The thumb is going to be not only the thumb, I'm going to plop my 2 feet and my other elbow. For those who vote Bugsy, you could find yourself question of the week very quickly. So let's throw it out for a vote, and we'll take the first 5 emails. It has to be an odd number, right? So the first 5...
You'd be sacrificing your integrity just to get your question answered on the show.
The next 5 emails, Bugs or Bugsy, and that will be my call sign name. And if the fighter pilot, you have an issue with that, let me know.
But by the way, there's several shows coming up where Jim's not going to be here.
That's
so
right.
I get to control who gets on the show.
Beginning in mid-May. That's right. I totally forgot I'm not going to be here. Well, no, I'm gone in 2 weeks. That gives us plenty. Voting closes May 1st. Just pointing that out. Anyways, seriously, okay. though, should I be Bugs or Bugsy? First 5 votes will count. And the first 5 emails.
That's it? We're only getting 5 votes?
I'll be lucky to get 5. Okay. We might only get 1, and then I'll have to make up the other 4.
Okay.
But the first 5 emails, Bugsy or Bugs, for my nickname. He's going to go up to votes. That was the rule set by our fighter pilot listener who gave us our call signs.
Okay.
And we'll go from there. On a more serious note, folks, I did receive several emails from people who wanted to get together when I'm out in Ohio. One gentleman invited me hiking. I need to reach out to him. It was a very nice email, and I wanted to go hiking with him. I'm not going to be able to make it to Ohio. My mom took ill, and she needs help. So I will be in Kansas City. When is it? It's next week, isn't it? It's already coming up. Goodness. Next week, I have several people I'm meeting in Kansas City. I'm looking forward to meeting you. And then I'm going to fly to Sarasota, take care of my mom for about 12 days, and then fly back to Kansas City for my Ed Slott training. The first training I'm doing is estate planning training. And then I'll go back in 12 days after taking care of my mom, and my sister will get down to take over when I leave. And I'll do my Ed Slott training, and then I'm going to come back. So for the people who wanted to try to meet in Ohio, I'm not going to be able to. If anybody listening to this podcast is in where's my mom? Venice.
Sarasota.
Venice. Well, she calls it Sarasota, but she actually lives in Venice. I'll be flying into Sarasota, but I will be in Venice I don't think I have to stay with her 24/7. So if anybody's in the Venice area, I got nothing to do. So if you want to go grab a bite to eat or something, send me an email and we'll try to get together. I'll be there for 12 days. But no Ohio. Ohio is out. Mom comes first. Mom's in her 80s and needs help. So I'm stepping up. So anyways, I did want to put that out there as well. And hopefully I can be back in Ohio and Northern Kentucky in the fall. It'll just be too hectic to try to do it before then. But anyways, wanted to bring everybody up to date on that as well. As far as today's show goes, this morning, I usually always read the Wall Street Journal in the morning, and a article, many of you, you do it yourself, has probably read this article and picked up on it right away and thought, oh goodness, let me read this. And it caught my attention right away. And it's titled, Cut Your Retirement Spending Now, says creator of the 4% rule.
Now, I do want to throw Wall Street Journal under the bus a little bit because they're referring to his old original rule. And he's not saying cut it from 4. I'll let a little of the cat out of the bag. He's saying cut it back from what his most recent recommendation was, which was a 4.7% rule, which we've talked about. He's talking about cutting it back a little bit from that, but not to below the 4. So this headline starts out a little grating on my nerves.
Well, scare sells. Remember? True. It's a newspaper. Caught my eye. Yeah. And it caught my eye mostly because I know Bill Benjamin, not personally, but he is the creator of a massive piece of what the financial services industry is based upon. And even though I think Bill set out and still has very high standards and he truly was trying to create something, unfortunately, in my oh-so-humble opinion at times, I think the financial services industry has hijacked his good work and turned the 4% rule into just a marketing gimmick to allow them to manage assets on an AUM basis and peel money from people. But don't get us going into that. We're not going to go down that road. What we're going to do, like we normally do, folks, is we read articles sometimes, and then we opine our opinion. I do want to say we're going to read this article. There's going to be some things that Bill is quoted as saying we're going to agree with him wholeheartedly on. And there's going to be other things that we disagree. But we disagree professionally. We're not being disrespectful. I have, again, great admiration for him. There's only a few people. I don't want to say a few, but there's a couple of people in this industry that I think Chris and I will wholeheartedly would go out of our way to listen to. Bill Benjamin would be one. Natalie Choate would be another. Ed Slott, Kitsis. My goodness, that guy is just oozing with information. There's some people in this industry that we respect and we would love to go listen to. We may not agree with everything they say. What we want to do is read the article, and I'm sure many of you already have, but we want to relate what I still think is the fundamental weakness to whatever rule it is. Morningstar recently came out and said it was the 3.3% rule. This just happened a couple months ago, and it caused a tizzy in the industry. And Bill came out then with an article not too long after that, kind of poking holes in Morningstar and saying it's actually 4.7. And now, a couple of weeks later, it's now, oh, wait, it's got to be cut yet again. And Harvard came out with a, I think it was Harvard, I could be wrong on that, said it was 2.7. And that came out a little over a year, year and a half ago. So there's all of these safe withdrawal rates, these safe withdrawal rates. I hate this approach to retirement planning. And this is my opinion and Chris's opinion. He wouldn't be working with me. He doesn't work for me. He works with me. He wouldn't be working with me trying to create what we're doing if he didn't believe in what I always felt. And that's important to me. I'm happy he believes in it. And I don't think you'd be listening to this podcast if you didn't believe in it. What I don't like, because you're entering the last phase of your life, the last quarter, or 20%, or 30% of your life. We don't know when we're going to pass away, so I don't know how many years you have, but it's the end, folks. We're not getting younger, we're not getting stronger, we're not getting healthier. What I've always hated with a safe withdrawal rate, twofold, I would see firsthand people unnecessarily constraining their fun spending because they've been bred to think, this money has to last, this money has to last, this money has to last. Your fun money does not have to last. It should not last. Fun money left over is life unlived. I used to say money left over is life unlived until people thought I meant literally, because I joked once, your last check that you write should bounce. But fun money left over is life unlived. That's what you saved it for. All you do-it-yourself investors, again, stop looking at your savings as assets. Look at it what it is, deferred spending. Someone's going to spend it. You will, your beneficiaries will, or the government will, or a charity will. One of those four entities is going to spend your money. It's spending. It's deferred spending. It's not an asset. It isn't. It's deferred spending, folks. Someone's going to consume it. What I always saw, Chris, in the industry firsthand with clients of us, and never mention any names, but you know who I'm talking about. We have clients who've died 1, 2, 3 years into retirement. We've had others who've suffered major medical issues into retirement and can't do what they wanted to do. And they unnecessarily, the industry trains people to unnecessarily spend money very conservatively across the board. The cynic in me says it's because they just want a simple way to take a little bit of your money every year. They're going to call it the AUM model, assets under management, for those who don't know what it means. They're going to put you in one big portfolio. There's your allocation. We're going to be 60-40, 55-45, 70-20, or 30, whatever it is. They're going to come up with some allocation mix, and they're going to limit you to spending just from that. They're going to do a Monte Carlo probability projection, which is worthless to begin with. And they're going to do all these different things in it, but all the while in an effort, in my, again, I admit, jaundiced opinion, to be able to manage that pool of money and withdraw 1, 1.25, 1.5% of it. It is scalable, it's marketable, it's easy for them. They can do it with computers and algorithms, and they can gather 100, 1,000, 10,000, 100,000 clients and just pull a little bit of money every month from it or every quarter and make a killing. I see it. I'm not saying everyone in this industry does that, but I think they took Chris Bill's excellent research and the work he did and have turned it into just this money-making machine. And I don't think that's what Bill ever truly wanted. So those are the two issues I have. It unnecessarily constrains fund spending when you're not getting younger, stronger, and healthier. You really only have the go-go phase of fun spending before you enter the slow-go phase. And I'll let Chris, he will get a word in edgewise and more than that, trust me, folks. But Chris pointed out when he read the article, it sounded to you, Chris, that Bill was entering what phase?
The slowdown phase, because he admitted he just doesn't do much anymore.
Right, the slow-go phase. Bill's in his 70s now, late 70s, I believe. And he's admitted in the article, he doesn't do much. He's slowing down. The phase is, assuming you don't die early or a medical condition doesn't arrive earlier than expected. We're all going to die someday, and it's all going to be medically driven unless we die in an accident. He's in the slow-go phase, and then eventually it's no-go. My mom and dad are in no-go. Mom was in slow-go until she suffered her medical condition that I'm going to go help her with now. But dad is definitely in slow-go. I was talking to you this morning about it, Chris. My dad is recently excited because he went out to eat with a $100 gift certificate I sent to him for a seafood restaurant near his house. He's 87. His wife is I think, her early 80s or late 70s. They were just so ecstatic, Chris, to go out and enjoy a seafood dinner. And I told Chris, my goodness, if they, instead of being in their 70s and 80s, were in their late 50s, early 60s, that would have bored them because they're still in the go-go phase of retirement. I believe in an approach to retirement planning where you back out all your expenses from your pool of assets. Again, we call it a big cherry pie. map the assets to the liability. It's not rocket science. Academically, we're asset liability mapping. I call it positioning. But slice up that pie, back it out so you know what your fund budget is, that we call your fund number, and then consume a hell of a lot of that during your go-go phase, because you don't need it in slow-go and no-go. But you do save and protect your minimum dignity floor of food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare. You do take care of your aging, and that's both what I call the aging for your lifestyle and the aging for your life. The latter is LTC, long-term care. The former, that's having enough money to hire people to cook, clean your house perhaps, do landscaping, things that you do yourself but you're not going to be able to. So you take care of your aging, you take care of a guaranteed inheritance, and you take care of a buffer. What's left is fun. So we're going to read the article. I'll read. Chris will opine. And just try to point out where we agree, where we disagree. So with that intro and why I want to do it, Chris, anything you want to get? I know you read the article. Very rarely do I give Chris the article ahead of time. This time I did. Anything you want to say before I just start reading it and you start sharing your thoughts?
No, hopefully most listeners have some familiarity with Bill Benjamin's work and the 4% rule. I'm doing air quotes there. That's been around for quite some time now all the way since 80, whatever that was. I'm sure it probably says in the article the year it was created in the first place. But it'd be hard to have paid any attention to retirement planning and not have run across the 4% rule at some point, or a variation thereof. So if you don't know what that is, you might want to pause this and look a little bit into the basics, because I don't think we're going to start from scratch on this conversation. It's going to be really mostly about how Bill, his current thinking is in regard to the 4% rule, given the current circumstances and environment. So
right.
we can just touch on it as you bring up things, because right. there's some interesting quotes he has in here.
The 4% rule is often called the SWR in retirement planning, safe withdrawal rate. How much can you withdraw from your portfolio every year, adjusted for inflation, and have a good chance of not outliving your money? That's what the 4% rule is. It varies. According to, again, Harvard, it's 2.7, Morningstar 3.3, Bill originally 4. It was actually 4.1, I think, or 4.1 something when he came out with it, but it got rounded to 4. Now it's 4.7, and according to Bill in this article, it's even a little bit lower than that. It's all over the map, but it's called safe withdrawal rate, and it's often married to another concept, listeners, called Monte Carlo, where they're going to project all these different market hypotheticals based on the allocation you have and the standard deviation of all of them, and give you what is called the spaghetti graph, which usually they call them iterations. They'll run 500 or 1,000 or 10,000 iterations. Each iteration is a different hypothetical outcome, and they average all of those, whether it's 500, 1,000, 10,000, and they'll have one doc line that shows the average of them all, and then you'll see lines ahead and below, all giving you these different ending values of what your portfolio is. And when I look at that, Chris, I see all that deferred spending that you never got to enjoy, because you're dead. You're gone. And a lot of advisors pat themselves on the back, where they could say to people, well, you might die with $10 million. I'd be PO'd if I had an advisor. Well, I'm going to be doing this, and then whoever takes over our firm will be doing it. But I'm going to fire the person if on my deathbed they pat me on the back and say, Jim, you did a great job. You're going to die with $10,000. I'm going to say, you failed. You could have had me spend more of this on fun while we could have. And that's our whole take on this. All right, let me start reading the article, and then you can add what you think or not think. And I'm sure many of you read it already, but it's from Anne Turgeson, something like that, whatever. Sorry, Anne, if I butchered your name.
Turgeson, probably.
Turgeson? It's not Turgeson?
I doubt it.
Oh, no. What do I know? Okay, so it begins. For decades, retirees have relied on the 4% rule to determine how much was safe to spend in retirement. Now the rule's inventor says current market conditions may require an even more conservative approach.
Let's see that. It's already wrong because they're misinterpreting what he says later, but you'll see what I mean when Jim gets to it.
The combination of 8.5% inflation with high stock and bond market valuations make it difficult to forecast whether the standard playbook will work for recent retirees, said retired financial planner Bill Benjamin, who first devised the 4% rule in 1994. So it was in 94.
94, not 80s. I thought it was late 80s, but yeah. Mm-hmm.
He did it when, again, I talked about this. Whatever the most popular Excel, it wasn't Excel back then. Lotus
1-2-3.
Yeah, something like that. Whatever the first Excel, the first spreadsheet was. He was one of you do-it-yourselfer engineer-style nuts, folks. So he just wrote a spreadsheet to try to figure this all out. Okay, the article continues. He now recommends retirees take a less aggressive approach to drawing down their nest eggs, at least until we determine whether the current surge in prices that has been particularly stressful to those on fixed income is a long-term trend or a short-term blip. I want to pause there real quickly because when I read those living on a fixed income, I read those unwilling to spend their deferred spending. They saved the money, and now they're going to try to live off of what that money generates? That's not the point of saving it.
Or people that don't have money saved, and they literally are living on just a small pension or Social Security, which is the fixed
income. But then they wouldn't need
piece.
A withdrawal. I'm just assuming these people, if they're reading a safe withdrawal...
True.
If you just have pension or Social Security, yes, that's fixed income. To a degree, Social Security rises. But you don't have to worry about withdrawing assets. If somebody has a pool of money and they're withdrawing assets or they're trying to live off of a quote-unquote fixed income, well, maybe I'm misinterpreting what that means. Maybe the fixed income is the 4% withdrawal adjusted for inflation. Or it's literally the income that it generates. But either way, Chris, it's a refusal to spend your deferred spending. If you can, again, identify the fun spending, the part of your cherry pie that can go for fun, I don't want you to unnecessarily spend it. Chris wants you to spend...
Save it.
Save it. That's what you meant. You're up to like 80%, isn't it, that you encourage people? I know you
depends on the length of the go-go period.
You drew me up, right. Yeah. I used to be at about 50, 60%. When I did what Chris does at our firm, Bill, Bill, he could be listening.
Bill, yeah.
He could be listening. Sticking little pins in voodoo dolls looked like Bugsy and Cowboy here. But sorry, I don't know if you're listening, Bill. When I used to do what Chris does, listeners, and meet with people, I used to encourage people to spend about 50, 60% of their fund number on GoGo until Chris literally explained to me he disagrees and why. Why don't you explain that, Chris? Because you got me on your side now to spend even more, and I think you're up to like 80, but why don't you take a little bit of time and explain to people what we're talking about there?
I think when you break it up and think of it as the GoGo, slow-go, and no-go periods, it sounds like, you know, a third and a third and a third. First of all, it's going to vary depending on your age and your retirement date, how long each of those are. Some people have a very short go-go period. Some people have a really extended go-go period. You need to look at things a little differently depending on which one of those you are. But when we look at the slow-go and no-go period, a very typical retirement would be someone in their mid-60s retiring, and the go-go in our, you know, typical situation that we see, we've got 10, 12 years of go-go in that particular time frame up to the mid-70s or so. When we look at it that way and we break it up into those three pieces, the initial inclination is to break it up into thirds. But we have to remember that the spending need or desires, the ability to spend that money on expensive things, is highly, highly biased or focus towards the go-go period. The things you tend to do after you're 85 plus are just not as expensive. It's not that you're not doing anything at all. It's just the things that you do are typically not very expensive. When you take off the board extensive travel or what we would call adventures that take a lot of physical effort to do them, You take those off the board and they're just, unless you have a super expensive hobby, there's just not a lot to spend enormous amounts of money on when you're in the no-go period in particular, and even the slow-go period. So when you look at it, there's that great decline most likely that's going to happen. And second, and that's assuming you're even around, right? There's zero fun spending if you're no longer with us. And that's a possibility as well. But when we look then at the decline in combination with the fact that you're now putting money aside that is going to hopefully grow over period, that the assumption is reasonable growth in that money, then when we draw back to the beginning of retirement, we realize we don't have to set that much aside to have some decent spending in the projections for the slow-go and no-go period. It just doesn't need that much to fund reasonable spending expectations for fun in those phases of retirement, which leads me to encourage people that if they truly have got everything else protected and they're just carving up the fun part of the cherry pie, the fun number itself, that they should honestly consider devoting as much as 70 or 80% of that number to that initial go-go period. Not everyone will do it, but I think that's a more reasonable ceiling to consider than 50 or 60%, like in your case. When I saw that and I ran a few numbers and did a few projections, it just left too much for the slow-go, no-go period. Just we looked at, that's going to support X amount of spending at a reasonable assumed rate of return over the next 10 to 20 years. Do we really need that much set aside for that kind of spending at that age? And for the vast majority of people, the answer is no. Not that we want to forecast you're going to be sitting on the porch in a rocking chair doing absolutely nothing. But like Jim pointed out, once you get in your late 80s, if you're still around, the things you do just are not that expensive for fun. There are certainly expensive things in your life. That's usually medical expenses, but that's handled differently. That's not the pool we're talking about here.
Exactly. And the one thing I want to point out, there's no right or wrong answer here, folks. None whatsoever. Right. You put aside whatever you want out of the go-go, slow-go, no-go. Some people might put more for the slow and no, and others might put more in the go-go. We never tell a client that we're working with, oh, no, this is wrong. You need to relook at it. It's whatever makes them feel comfortable. And you might be saying, why do you do this? Because go-go money, in my oh-so-humble opinion, is just as important as minimum dignity floor expenses. I didn't work my entire life. I didn't create a lifetime of passions and enjoyments that I want to ignore for the last 6, 8, 10, 12 years of my ability perhaps to enjoy them. I want to make sure I can do them when I want. So we encourage people, especially you do-it-yourself investors, when you figure out your fund number and then you break out your go-go pot of it, that money should be protected. This notion in our industry, Chris, that fund spending can be cut if you had to, I think is failure, malpractice, whatever you want to call it. I don't think that is a sound approach to retirement planning at all. To tell someone, oh, put off that dream vacation. Put off, I told you the story of the person who bought the truck but didn't buy the teardrop camper to pull with it. Oh, put that off for a couple of years. No, you don't know if this is it. It's your last hurrah, folks, like it or not. I don't know. If you put it off for 1, 2, 3, 4 years for the quote-unquote market to recover, if you will then be able to enjoy whatever it is you put off. And instead, you're going to become the Debbie Downer that my dad in his retirement community where he lives now always talks about. The people, he described them as the people with money but can't spend it. He says they are they're more of a downer, they call them Debbie Downers, than the people who have no money but have great stories of what they did with it when they blew it in the last phase of their lives before they had to go into a retirement community. So, again, that's just our opinion. You may disagree with it as you plan your own retirement, but it's just the way we tend to look at things.
Yeah. Okay. So I think it's, we have to admit that it's possible to cut it. It's a travesty if you go on into retirement with that attitude or being encouraged by this, quote, advisor. Hey, we'll see how things go. If things don't work out so well, if there's a downturn, oh, don't worry. It's just the fun money. That you can, you know, that's flexible. That's discretionary. You can cut it if you need to. We'll just see how things go. Problem with that approach, as you've pointed out, but the thing that really bugs me the most is that they admit that you can then spend more when we see if things recover or go well. If things go extra well, oh, look, you can spend extra. Well, Mr. or Mrs. Advisor, when can you tell me that? Oh, we'll have to see how things go. Yeah,
we'll
let you know
at 85.
Right, at 75 or 80, we'll know if things are going better than we expected, and then we'll release more money to you. You've got to be kidding me. You've got to be kidding me. Do they think suddenly everyone's going to become immortal and is going to have exactly the same ability to do things at every age? That's ridiculous. You need to know what you can spend in the go-go period. In the go-go period.
Not after.
Not after. It does you no good after to discover this.
Hence the Debbie Downer that my dad talks about. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the article continues. Mm-hmm. The long-standing method calls for spending 4% in the first year of retirement and then adjusting that amount annually to keep pace with inflation. Such an approach would have protected retirees from running out of money in every 30-year period since 1926, even when economic conditions were at their worst, Mr. Benjamin said. Mm-hmm. Okay. Essentially what, again, he found, or is essentially saying if you read his work, is that there was money left over in nearly every 30-year period.
Not nearly every. Every 30-year period, if you restricted your distributions to that 4% starting amount and then adjusting for inflation. That's what he did in the spreadsheet, is he ran 30-year periods starting in 1926 and then starting in 1927 and then 1928, went through and looked at every single one of them and found the withdrawal rate that made it so that no starting 30-year period ended up with you running out of money. That's how we discovered the 4% rule. The problem, and I want to jump down the article because it ties specifically to this methodology. He admitted a little bit later on, he said when he did this, those who retired in the best of times when stocks were cheap and interest rates and inflation were low could have taken out as much as 13% to start. And the average withdrawal was 7% would have been successful on average. So here he's admitting, we're going to restrict everybody to 4, but you, depending on when you retire, you could have spent 3 times that, 13% instead of 4, and still been okay.
But you're not told to do that until the end.
Those are the people who ended up with a ton of money at the end and could have enjoyed their lives so much more if they would have known that they were on that trajectory. Now, I don't know what trajectory you're on, but if you take a different approach to it, you can then free up a lot more of this money as your cherry pie fun number and know that number. Knowing it is 90% of the battle, right? People can budget around a number that they know. Discovering what that number is unleashes your ability to maximize enjoyment with that number. So that's, I just wanted to tie that to that paragraph that's coming up later down here because it directly relates and I think shows the weakness of the 4% rule right there. He admits that while 4 was the most you could take out to guarantee you didn't run out of money during those, in this is hindsight, right? This is looking at historical stock market performance. So this, there's no guarantee the future this is going to work. That's what this article is about. Do we, you know, can we apply this for the future? Do we need to adjust it? But he said in the history, some people could have taken out as much as 13, but we would have been telling them, if we lived back then and told them before they went into retirement, oh, restrict it to 4. I would be irate if I then found out I could have been taken 13. But
exactly. Whatever. And it ties into what Chris and I have been saying, our issue with any safe withdrawal rate, whether it's the 2.7, 3.3, 4.7, 4, pick one. We still have issues with it. Okay. The problem, the article continues, the problem is there is, and this is now quoting Bill, the problem is that there is no precedent for today's conditions, and by conditions he means market conditions, folks, for today's conditions, he said. His concern echoes a recent report from Morningstar, which recommends a 3.3% initial withdrawal rate for those retiring today who want spending to keep pace with inflation over 30 years and a high degree of certainty that their money will last. Again, a high degree of certainty. They're not saying it's going to last. They just want a high degree of certainty. Fund money need not last. Minimum dignity floor, food, utilities, transportation, housing, and health care, that had better last. Hence Chris and I's desire to not cover those expenses with a quote-unquote safe withdrawal rate, which this own article doesn't even say they will last. It's just a high degree of certainty. Those should be covered with guaranteed lifetime income, Social Security, pension, income annuities. Yes, the four-letter word, annuity. I know a lot of do-it-yourselfers hate that word, but income annuities can help support.
Annuity is seven letters.
Huh?
So it was a four-letter word.
No, four-letter word is the acronym or the, you know, four-letter word like, you know,
oh, a bad word.
The bad, it's words, a bad word. Yes, okay. Right. It's a bad word. I know annuity has more than four letters, but usually when you want to say something, you say,
okay,
oh.
Okay, I get it. I see what you're saying.
Yeah. Okay. So that's what I meant by four-letter word, folks. Okay. I'm at the point of the article where his picture is. He looks a little like my dad. Just want to point that out.
I agree a little bit.
He's got, yeah, my dad kind of looks like, he's got that little white mustache thing there going, that dad and the glasses. Yeah, it looks a little bit like dad. Okay. Mr. Benjamin's latest revision doesn't necessarily mean going below 4%, he said. That's because the 4% rule really hasn't been the 4% rule for some time. His original research was based on a portfolio with 55% U.S. large cap U.S. stocks and 45% intermediate treasury bonds. 55-45 moderate portfolio, folks, we'll all agree on that. Since 2006, he revised that portfolio to add international stocks, mid-size stocks, small-cap stocks, and micro-cap stocks, as well as treasury bills. So instead of just holding intermediate bonds, he's going a little bit into the T-bills. That raised returns and supported a safe withdrawal rate to 4.7. Mm-hmm. I have a huge issue with that whole theory. Essentially what he was saying, I took more investment risk and allowed you to take more money. I can't believe that that is a viable solution.
And well, in the long run, the numbers would support that. The problem is it ignores some key factors, some key risks that you're going to run into. And if you he overcomes the risk that introduces. That introduces the risk that you have bad returns early.
Sequential risk, which we've always been talking about.
But they mitigate that by having this low safe withdrawal rate. I mean, yes, it's higher, but it's still relatively low. 4.7, when they admitted it, could have been as high as 13, right? In good years, or on average, 7 would have worked. 4.7 is on the, they're keeping that real conservative because they've opened themselves up to more sequential risk. So that's how they mitigate that. It's a trade-off.
I've always said, folks, if your retirement is predicated on taking on more investment risk and getting a higher potential return, that's the only way you're going to be able to fund what it is you want to do. You shouldn't be retiring or you shouldn't be doing what it is you want to do. You cannot rely on these returns. And I was appalled back in 26 when these studies were coming out, and I'm equally appalled now that the answer is just take more investment risk. Well, what if that investment risk doesn't match your risk tolerance? What if it, or more importantly, what if it doesn't match your risk capacity? If you don't understand the difference between risk capacity and risk tolerance, listeners, Google it and read up on it. Risk capacity is what Chris and I pay attention to as retirement planners. I don't give a darn about your risk tolerance. The regulators say I have to because to them, it all revolves around risk tolerance. which is your emotional reaction to risk. The keep me from jumping off the ledge, please, Jim, reaction to risk. So when I say I don't care about it, I don't wake up at 3 in the morning wondering about Mr. and Mrs. Smith's risk tolerance. I might wake up literally, and I have in the past, wake up early in the morning sometimes thinking about certain clients at certain times of their lives or during the market. But I'm looking at it, Chris, from a risk capacity standpoint. Can their portfolio handle this loss? Well, that's hard to predict when everything is rolled up into a one-size-fits-all asset management 55-45, large cap, small cap, intermediate, large cap, small cap, mid cap, micro cap, international stock mixed with intermediate bonds and T-bill type portfolio. What the hell is this one-size-fits-all? Break your spending out. Slice that cherry pie. Each cherry pie slice has its own risk capacity and therefore will have its own investment allocation. You don't need to limit a 55-45 mix. It should be 100% equities on that piece of cherry pie that you put in the freezer because you want it to be inherited by a kid in 20 years or 30 years or however long it is before you pass away. And even when the kid inherits it, maybe it's inside a Roth IRA, they don't have to sell it for another 10 years. And even then, they don't have to sell the investments. They can transfer the assets out and still hold them and still grow it. So now it's more of a 30, 40, 50 year period before they're going to sell it. So that should be 100% equities. But a one-size-fits-all portfolio with a safe withdrawal rate forces that inheritance to your kid, Chris, being unnecessarily invested uber-conservatively.
Right.
But it also forces money that you want to spend on fun to maybe be, a quote-unquote, in quotation marks here, folks, aggressively invested in a 55-45 moderate portfolio when it should be held maybe in cash. Yes, another four-letter word to you do-it-yourself investors, cash. Well, cash is king, folks, as far as I'm concerned, on money that you want to spend. If you need to earn a certain level of return on quote-unquote cash for your fund spending that you want to do on the first 5, 6, 7 years of retirement, your go-go phase, you might not want to be retiring. If you don't have enough money to fund that go-go phase in a lump sum, you have to earn a 5, 6, 7, 8, 9% return on it. You can't handle, you don't have the risk capacity to handle the potential risk of a loss on that money to get a 5, 6, 7, 8, 9% return. You should be able to put 100% of your go-go fund money in cash. I'm not saying you will do it, but you should be able to. If you can, you can fully fund that fund, folks. If you have enough money to put in there for fun, you can do it. Hopefully this all makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we continue going on. Given the challenge of making forecasts right now, Mr. Benjamin suggests cutting spending if possible.
I'm going to call the friendly utility and tell them I just don't feel so comfortable, so can I pay only part of my electrical bill this month?
Exactly. I love the word if possible. That's the save. That's the get out of jail free card. That's the you can't sue me. I put if possible. And I'm not saying Bill is going to be sued. I'm talking about other people in the industry now. This notion that you can cut spending only applies to fun. And Chris and I still think it's not appropriate at all. If you can't gather that from this podcast, go back and listen from the beginning. But you can't cut, as Chris said, your utilities, your healthcare, your food. You can massage them. I've always said that.
A little bit, yeah.
You can cut them on the ends. It's like a bell curve. You can snip off the ends, but you're not going to be able to remove them or cut them dramatically. So he goes on. Where is it? Given the challenge of making forecasts right now, Mr. Benjamin suggests cut spending if possible. New retirees with highly diversified portfolios that could normally support a 4.7% withdrawal rate might want to start around. Do we have a drum roll with his new number? Probably not. Do we have that drum roll? No? Okay. 4.4%.
Yeah.
So as Chris said, not a massive cut, just 20 basis points.
It's about a 7% reduction.
I was going to ask, what is that in
percentage
points?
He's asking you to reduce your spending about 7%, which if you cut your fund by 30, maybe your overall spending does get cut by 7, because if we assume you can't cut the minimum dignity floor, you could achieve the 7 by focusing all cuts on, quote, discretionary spending, which if he's in his mid-70s in the slow-go period, maybe that's not concerning to him. Actually, he goes on, as you're going to point out in a minute, I won't eat in restaurants as much. I live a fairly simple life. I don't take a lot of trips, and I'm happy with a deck of cards and three other bridge players. He's clearly slowed way down, although I don't know how much of that he did before, but he implies that he did. If you're in the middle of the go-go period and you suddenly get the message from Bill Benjamin or anybody else, you need to cut your spending by 9%, that's problematic. That's problematic.
But it's still also unnecessarily limiting your fund spending because you, again, you're talking or listening, folks, you're not talking to me, to a man who should have died 18 months ago. You all know the story when I had that massive stroke. And at any time, something bad can happen. We all know that. Last night, I'm sitting on the couch, went into AFib again. Starting to tick me off on this, Chris. Now I have to, who knows? But it was a reminder, Chris, of my own mortality yet again. That at any time, I might not be so lucky with the next stroke. It can happen to anyone, not just me. I freely talk about the things that I am experiencing to help people. And I have AFib, and I'm not going to hide from it. I have all the health issues associated with that. Things can happen. Yes, he's saying cut spending 7%. Maybe you could spend 30% more in some given year on fun. I don't understand. I'm not saying every year spend 30% more, but this notion that, oh goodness, I have to cut my spending by 7%. Chris and I might be telling you, hey, your fund budget is $987,000, just making this number up, $987,000. If we had a client call us up and say, hey, Jim, my fund budget is $987,000, how's it? Well, let's say they're a do-it-yourself investor, and I have half of it in cash. So, God, I can't even figure out in my head what half of $987,000 is. I should have had a nice round number here.
$493,500.
This is what I thought it was. I got $493,000 in cash. We're going to take $100,000 out and go around a round-the-world cruise. Again, I'm just making this whole thing up. Are you sure we can still do this? Is everything okay? Now, we could, if they were in our retirement planning program, Chris and his team could crunch some numbers. Yep, everything still looks good. Boom, there goes $100,000 out. Under a safe withdrawal rate, that would be unheard of. Because for some unknown, godforsaken reason, fund spending needs to be guaranteed forever, and you should die with some and be happy on your deathbed that some of your fund money is left over. I just don't get that. Okay, so Chris is correct. Bill goes on to explain. He's pretty much just eating in restaurants. Well, he's willing to cut eating in restaurants because he's happy sitting around a table with a deck of cards and three other bridge players. And maybe in your late 70s, early 80s, in a slow-go phase, playing bridge, sitting outside, drinking some Mai Tais or mimosas in Florida. I don't know where Bill lives. But is great. Not so great for a 58, 60, 63, 65, even 68-year-old retiree in your go-go phase. You want to be doing that maybe on the deck of a cruise ship. Me? I don't want to be on a cruise ship. I want to be on the back end of a salmon fishing vessel trying to catch some salmon and pull up some halibut in Nova Scotia or, well, that would be the East Coast. But in Alaska. Alaska or in Vancouver. That's the other the island on the other side of Canada. We all have different things we want to do. Don't tell me I have to make my fun last. Help me find what my fun number is. Help me slice my cherry pie and tell me out of my $1, $2, $3, $4, $5 million of deferred spending of my big ass cherry pie, how much of that cherry pie can I cut and use and spend on fun so I can spend the majority of it while I still can. Okay, In historic 30-year periods, Mr. Benjamin said, a 4% initial withdrawal rate was a safe point.
4.7.
What did I say?
You said 4.
Oh. Mr. Benjamin said a 4.7 initial withdrawal rate was a safe starting point. Those who retired in the best of times, when stocks were cheap and interest rates and inflation were low, could have taken out, and here's where you get to it, Chris, as much as 13% to start without running out of money. When do you find this out? When you die. But help you gives more deferred spending to your beneficiaries. Mm-hmm. And Chris, give a caveat. If that is important to you, what?
More power to you. That, and honestly, our fund number concept is consistent with that. Because when we figure out how much you really don't need for your own requirements, your minimum dignity floor, other requirements, other protections you might want, some preparation for aging and long-term care, all the things that you want to make sure are there for you, what's left, we call it playfully the fun number, because we want people to envision the vast majority of it's going to be for exactly that, for fun. But it's truly your discretionary pool, what's not needed for anything else that's of higher priority. And if you then want to carve off a piece of that discretionary pool, aka fun number, and say, no, this is for my kids to have fun with or to improve their lives when we're gone, totally fine. That's the point of being purely discretionary. You can do with it what you please and realize that it's not going to undermine your minimum dignity floor, aging, other guarantees or priorities that you might have, because you've dealt with that with other funds, maybe other secure income, other liquid assets you've devoted to them, things like that. You've already prioritized in the list. This is what's left over. Do with it as you please. And if what you please is to leave it behind, totally fine.
Right. So we'll continue, because I want to try to get through the whole article. Since 1926, Mr. Benjamin's research indicates, as Chris already mentioned, that a 7% withdrawal rate has been successful on inflation. On average. When inflation is high, withdrawals made under the 4% rule grow by leaps and bounds. Leaps and bounds, Mr. Benjamin said. That means the portfolio must earn a higher return to prevent depletion. What he means there in English, folks, you start with 4, but you got to increase it by 8.5, and then another 6, and then another 8, or another 9. These are massive increases due to inflation that he never thought of or modeled, and combine that with the potential that the forward-looking returns of investments are very muted because of the potentially high valuation of some asset classes. Chris and I don't want to sound like we're trying to time the market. Whether it's overvalued or not is a objective decision you need to make. But forward-looking returns, when Travis is the chief financial officer of our chief investment officer that works for us. That's his title, but he's an outsourced CFA at our firm. When he gives Chris every quarter his forward-looking return projections, what have they been doing, Chris, for the most part over the last few years, every time he gives them to you?
Last few years, they're kind of, like you said, muted, kind of historically lower because we've got historically high valuations, not never seen before in history, but at the upper end, you know, the upper end of the range. And I mean, you can see that if we're talking about stocks with current, you know, PE ratios, things like that, that's an indicator of relative valuations. And those numbers all indicate that relatively high valuations, and the more you pay up front for an investment, the lower your return will be moving forward. So if you're paying towards the high end of historical pricing, your expectations better be lower for forward-looking returns. That's exactly what we're seeing in the opinion of the analysts that contribute to these estimates that Travis supplies to us.
Right. So I'm going to skip the next couple of paragraphs because it just goes on to that a little bit more. Right. And I'm going to pick up where it says, in past periods of very high stock valuations, he added, he being again Bill Benjamin, it usually took a bear market to adjust prices back down to the mean. As a result, he said, we could be facing an extended period of subnormal returns. That's just investing 101 right there, folks. What it's saying is there's always the mean. You all know that, right, folks? And you can get volatility above the mean and below the mean. If it gets too far below the the mean. If it drops an awful lot, eventually the market comes back towards the mean. Then it shoots above the mean and gets very overvalued as we are now. And what's going to happen? It's going to fall. Don't tell me who they are. The band from the 60s, what goes up must come down, spinning wheel, run around. Bad Finger.
No.
Yes, it's Bad Finger. How much you want to bet? What goes up must go down is a Bad Finger. Go ahead, Google it real quick. But while he's getting that, I think I'm right on that one. It's Bad Finger, right? No. It ain't Middle Finger.
No.
It's Bad Finger. What goes up must go down, spinning wheels round and round. That's about all I know. But anyways, trying to say, folks, is
if you're talking about spinning wheel, which that does, unless that lyric is in something from Bad Finger, that's the spinning wheel from Blood, Sweat, and Tears.
Oh, it is Blood, Sweat, and Tears. Damn it, I thought it was Bad. What does Bad Finger sing? They have a song that is famous.
Oh, yeah. But I don't remember that lyric being attached to them.
Oh, so it's Blood, Sweat, and Tears, not Bad Finger. Okay. Yeah. Sorry about that, folks. We probably had people from the 60s screaming out the real name. Okay, back to what we're trying to get to. What Bill is saying, the market's overvalued and it's probably going to correct. And that, he goes on to say, when bear markets occur, retirees have to take money out of a portfolio that is shrinking. That is especially dangerous in early retirement because most retirees need their savings to last years. Mr. Benjamin said, what does that mean in English? Sequential risk. Mm-hmm. That's what he's saying. And it's brilliant. It's nothing that you don't learn studying for the CFP or studying basic investments. Sequential risk. We said that all the time. I often have said on this podcast, your riskiest day of retirement is day one. If you were to suffer a massive loss on day one, that's far more risky than you being 99 suffering a massive loss.
And the safe return rate approach to dealing with that is to have this conservative starting point, this 4% idea, or maybe less, the 3.3% that Morningstar was talking about. That's how they address that. They restrict the distribution so much that it overcomes the potential sequential risk. But that's not the only solution to sequential risk, right? We take a very different approach, and not just us, others as well, where you take the money that would be most affected by sequential risk, the money that you need to spend in the near term, 5 to 10 years, and you remove it from being affected by sequential risk. That's our approach.
Portfolio matching, as we already said, risk capacity. Mm-hmm. Positioning is what we call it in our firm. It goes by a term, bucketing as well. You know, if you listen to the podcast for a while, we don't like to use that. It's kind of been hijacked to sell annuities, so I don't like to use bucketing. Academically, time segmentation investing. Again, our positioning or our whole approach is asset liability mapping. Time segmented investing is the investment answer to how we position. And it's just mapping matching when you're going to need the asset to an appropriate investment. So again, it's not rocket science, but it's just how we use it at the firm. That's how we address sequential risk, because Bill is right in this article. This is a dangerous time to be retiring. We've got high inflation. We have overvalued bonds. How do we know bonds are overvalued? Interest rates were at never before seen lows over the past two or so years. As interest rates rise, bonds go down. We have others arguing, I think justifiably, that equities themselves are overvalued. You get the double whammy. You might not get the protection of bond and stock diversification because both might be going down at the same time. And this clearly has Bill worried, and he's saying reduce your withdrawals. That's all fine, but does that mean you lose on the lottery of life? The timing of retirement? That's the lottery of life, folks. Oh, gee, sorry, you were born in 58. You're screwed. It's too bad you weren't born in 68, because you'll be a lot better once this market correction happens. But because you were born in 58 and you're retiring now, you can't go out and have fun. That's BS. You just got to look at your assets, divide them out, figure out your fun number, protect that fund number, in my opinion, just like you would any important spending. Protect it and go and have fun and be damned what the stock market is doing, what the economy is doing, what geopolitical risk is happening. Just have fun. Okay. In contrast, if a bear market comes along after 20 years in retirement, again, in my example, someone born in 68 instead of 58, I'm just, again, making those years up, your portfolio has likely already increased in value, giving you a larger cushion. Plus, the retiree may not need the money to last as long. That's great, Chris, but you're already 20 years into retirement. Is that the time to find out that you can spend more on fun?
Too late.
If you retire at 65, I'm just picking that, you could retire at 58, 60, 62, 65. You retire at 65 and find out at 85, oh, geez, you're doing all right. There's no way you're going to outlive your money now. Is it because you have so much money or you have such a short life expectancy remaining? And if you stop and think, folks, even if you could live 20, 25, or 30 years in retirement, your go-go phase is probably between 6 and 12 years. Mm-hmm. It could be 30, 40, 50% of your retirement. It's a big chunk of your retirement. And you're going to, excuse me, from a percentage point, it's a big chunk of your retirement. As a percentage of your life, it's a very short period of time. 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years maybe. And you're going to restrict spending on fun during that time, only to be told in your 80s, go out and have, you could tell my mom today, go out and spend some of your money, and she'll look at you. I haven't seen her yet since her health issues. And I know my mom. She would have said to me, go to hell.
Or two words, on what?
True. On right, what?
I already do what I want. I already do what I want to do.
Well, no, I'm saying, but my mom with her health issues, and she's going to be okay, folks, from what I've been told. So I'm not putting mom under the bus, but I'm just saying, if I told my mom at 84, hey, mom, when you're better, you can go spend more money. She'd probably looked at me and said, go to hell. You should have told me that 20 years ago, because how am I going to do it now?
Right.
That's our point, listeners. Okay. We have had bursts of high inflation. Oh, wait a minute. I skipped a paragraph. While high short-term inflation poses some danger, the risks multiply when high inflation sticks around for longer, as was the case in the 1970s. Everybody listen to this. You probably remember the 70s. If you were born in the 70s, you have no idea what we're talking about. Do a little bit of research about what inflation was like in the 70s. We have had bursts of high inflation in the past, including after World War II, that have lasted just a year or two, said Mr. Benjamin. While these bouts of high inflation reduced the safe withdrawal rate, it wasn't by a dramatic amount. Mr. Benjamin's research indicates that the worst 30-year period in which to retire ever was October 1st, 1968. It wasn't 1968 itself that was the problem, but the years following, which were awful. Inflation was high for much of the 70s, and stocks encountered back-to-back bear markets. I don't remember the back-to-back bear markets because I wasn't investing back then, but through my studies and research, I know 69 and 73 were not good years. 2000, 2001, and 2002. For more recent, were not good years. So it's not unheard of to have multiple down years. But then he points out from the end of 65 to the end of 81, the annualized return in the S&P was virtually flat. This I know because part of that is what set the standards where I've embraced positioning, fund number, and all of that. Was that long period of time, Chris, I would look at those studies and see, what if someone does retire in a situation like that? That is horrendous. You've got to protect from an emotional standpoint from that. It could happen again. The problem with strong equity returns like we had over the past 13 years or through the 90s is people forget equities can go down. And then you enter the 2010s was the lost decade. What if we enter another one of those now? We had 13, 14 years of phenomenal equity returns, in my so humble opinion, artificially supported by crazy-ass policies that the Federal Reserve is doing to support unprecedented spending. Don't get me going on all this, but they have forced up the value. They admitted they wanted to force up the value of risk assets for one reason only, to make people feel like they were wealthier than they probably are, to go out and do what? Spend money. Because saving it wasn't going to do anything. So either spend it or invest it. You invest it, will drive up the value of more risk assets, and some people will make money off of it and go spend it. It's to me a house of cards, and it may come crumbling down. And that's what Bill is trying to point out here. So his answer is, aside from cutting spending, retirees can try to protect their nest eggs by reducing their exposure to stocks and bonds. While Mr. Benjamin said he would normally invest 55% of his savings, 55% in stocks and 45% in bonds, his concern about both have left him closer to 20% stocks, 10% bonds. So he's only invested about 30% of his money, with the rest, folks, in cash. This may be a reflection of Bill's age, because I don't know anything about it, but there's all these alternative investments that younger generations may be putting monies in, not cash. I would caution about doing that. It's totally up to you. We personally, as a firm, don't do that. But there are other things you could put the remaining 70% of your money in. I will also say, anybody in the 20s, 30s, 40s, maybe even early 50s listening to this podcast and thinking you need to move 70% of your money to cash, it's not what Bill is saying, it's not what I'm saying, it's not what Chris is saying. Do not do that. This whole article and this whole podcast is for people in the distribution phase. If you're in the accumulation phase, you can stop listening now. We should announce this at the beginning. This podcast has nothing to do with you. The accumulation phase, you should be praying for 30, 40, 50% drop in equities. And then you should be loading up and buying like crazy. But if you're in the distribution phase, Bill has a warning, and we agree. But Bill says, I'm uncomfortable holding that much in cash. But with the Federal Reserve announcing its intentions to aggressively raise interest rates, it's not a great time to be in financial assets. And by that, he means stocks and bonds. And he's saying, hold cash. Cash is king, said Mr. Benjamin, who said he plans to buy stocks if the market drops significantly and stocks become cheap. So Chris did point out he might be practicing a little bit of what, Chris?
Well, that's clearly a market timing comment there, which has its own. To his credit, though, he turns right around and warns against this, even though he says that's what he's going to try to do. He says that, you know, attempts to market time can backfire on investors. So that's, especially when you're playing this game later and later in life, when you're maybe not as sharp as you once were. Not that a young, sharp individual can market time effectively. I think there's plenty of evidence that shows that for the vast, vast majority of people, it's a losing approach. But that's what he's talking about doing here.
Exactly. And he ends with, Mr. Benjamin warns that, as Chris just pointed out, that attempts to time the market can backfire on investors. It's hard to buy stocks during bear markets. There's an emotional obstacle to doing that. Since investors fear, it can lead to more losses. But the last sentence, or the last paragraph, I don't know if it's one sentence or two, I think is important. Sounds benign, but I think it says a lot. I retired 9 years ago, so I'm probably safe, he said. But I'm not comfortable because I'm still early enough into retirement that the combination of threats we face could be damaging. I don't know if that last sentence, but I'm not comfortable because I'm still early enough into retirement that the combination of threats we face could be damaging. I don't know about that. I kind of disagree a little. The riskiest time for retirement, we said, is day one, but academically speaking, it's usually explained as the first half of retirement. If the average retirement lasts about 20 to 25 years, some will be longer, some will be shorter. Take half of 10 to 15, No, that's not what I'm saying. The answer is 10 to 15. If it's going to last 20 to 25 years, half is 10 to about 12 years is the first half of retirement. He's through most of the danger period of retirement. Mm-hmm. He's also in his late 70s.
He's already slowed down by his own admission. He's already stressing things less because he's taken less money out.
Right. And notice what he said, folks. He's been retired 9 years, but he described his life now is playing bridge, and he's happy. It shouldn't be us to poke fun that playing bridge is fun. In his late 70s, that's what he wants to do, and he's perfectly content and happy. Just like my dad in his late 80s is perfectly content and happy playing cards. I don't know if he plays bridge. I think he does play bridge, but he plays cards in the retirement community and Password. They got the little board game Password, and they play that, and he loves it. But someone, when Bill retired 9 years ago, might not have had so much fun playing bridge. Go-go, slow-go, no-go. We want you to find your fun number and spend during go-go. Him saying he's 9 years into retirement and is now playing bridge and is happy, he clearly has progressed from slow-go into no-go. And Chris and I have said your slow-go period could be about 6, 8, 10, 12 years, somewhere around there. It varies.
But it could be very short. A lot of people go straight from go-go to no-go, effectively.
Or dead-go.
True.
Unfortunately, zero you go. Pass away, yeah. Zero go. So I'm just pointing out why I say this last sentence is important, or the last paragraph is important. It clearly shows Bill has progressed from go-go to slow-go. What we just want to avoid is unnecessarily not spending during that go-go phase. And I'm sure he did, and I'm sure he managed his retirement fine. But if he limited himself to just spending 4.7% of his money during that phase, he might have unnecessarily limited itself on spending on fun. I don't know. I don't know who does his planning, if he does it himself, if he works with someone. He could be perfectly content and happy. What we just want to point out is maybe, just maybe, he could have spent more. And to be told that in your 80s, just to me, is rubbing salt in wounds. You're old. You're just not feeling good. You can't do it even if you wanted to. And to then be told, oh, by the way, your timing was perfect. You could have spent a hell of a lot more money. Just what Chris and I are trying to avoid. Anyways, that's it. Hopefully you mm-hmm. can learn more, folks, or understand more why me and Chris, he's just not as passionate a speaker as I am. I get into this. But why we believe in this type of approach to retirement planning. And you should start looking at figuring out what your fun number is. And you should protect your minimum dignity floor with lifetime guaranteed secure income. And this does not mean it's a one-time set it and forget it. We say this all the time. Needs to be monitored all the time. You don't need an investment advisor. I don't want to say financial planner anymore. You don't need an investment advisor, in my opinion, during your accumulation years. All you do-it-yourselfers realize that. Save the money you're going to pay them. Buy, hold, low-cost passive indexing. Do not enter retirement thinking you don't need professional help. I'm sorry, you do. You're a do-it-yourselfer in creating your wealth. You are not going to enter retirement and be able to spend that wealth. Strongly consider finding professional help. And this isn't a throw out to Chris and I. We've paused accepting new clients. So you couldn't hire us right now for retirement plans if you wanted to. We still do insurance, tax planning, and asset management, yes. But if you wanted retirement planning right now, we can't. So we're essentially telling you, go out and find someone who can help you right now, because we can't, not for retirement planning. But don't try to enter retirement alone. You're going to need help, and you need to find someone who truly knows what they're doing and work with that person or persons, but then monitor it throughout and have them monitor, not you. It should be on autopilot. Just hire people, let them worry about it, let them handle it, let them communicate with you on a regular basis of what needs to be done. They got your back. They're looking at it all. And go enjoy your go-go phase and not worry about updating your Excel spreadsheet to reflect this tax law change or looking at a 65-45 portfolio. That didn't add up, did it? 65-35 portfolio. Let someone...
That's the holy grail right there, the 65-45 portfolio.
It'd be great if we could do that. But it's called margin. Joking, folks.
Whoa,
do
yeah.
not go Easy. Do that. It's a joke. But you should strongly consider working with someone to help you and monitor it all the time. Even your fund number. Chris and I never tell anyone this fund number is set in stone. It's going to move. We'll help you. We'll monitor it with you. We'll work with you. We'll contact you as necessary. We'll update the numbers. We'll look at the taxes and the withdrawals and the estate planning where so many people don't follow. Even the updates to Medicare every year after 65. All of these things should be done by the firm you're working with. So anyways, it just hopefully you found this interesting. I did, but you get a better idea of why we just don't like SWR approach to retirement or safe withdrawal rate. I think the argument so much, Chris, is what is the safe withdrawal rate in our industry rather than an argument of is the safe withdrawal rate a reasonable and fair approach to retirement planning? My answer is no.
Right. And I'll throw out just because some people might be thinking this, that there's got to be a cost. What's the downside to the way we do it? It can't all be good news or everyone would have embraced it. I will admit the obvious downside, if you want to point to it as a downside, is that you give up the potential for the lucky asset trajectory where you end up with a whole ton of money at the end. Because we're essentially taking steps to allow you to spend more up front, which just is naturally going to suppress what you have at the end, but you're a little more in direct control of it. You're making conscious decisions about what portion is going to be left, not just this whole pile that's mixed in together. If we end up, quote, lucky, it'll take off and grow, and we're not going to take much out because we're restricting ourselves to a safe withdrawal rate. That potential of that massive growth that you might see in those Monte Carlo simulations, you give that up. In ours, it's going to suppress that naturally because we're encouraging and we're designing a process that encourages you to spend more upfront during the go-go period on your discretionary spending, which, you know, the more you spend, it is going to reduce the ending number, whatever that ending number might be. But we're going to put in other protections so that you're protected from the downside of the distribution of possible outcomes, right? Those, the running out of money situation. That's why our protections for the minimum dignity floor and those other things are dealt with separately. But it does shave off the top of those potential high, high leftover amounts. So if that's your goal, you don't want to necessarily take our approach. If your goal is to leave as much behind as possible, then yes, restrict your spending as much as you possibly can and invest for the goal of leaving as much behind as possible. Our approach isn't attractive to people who are, you know, prioritizing that behavior.
Right. And it makes me think of another article I read today, and we're not going to certainly read that one, but it was about younger folk. I don't have kids. Chris does. But every once in a while, I'll read about what the younger generations are doing, people in their 20s and 30s. And this was someone in their late 20s whose whole approach was different. And they said something in that article, and I just remembered it. I can't remember if it was a guy or a girl they were featuring. I think it was a female, but I could be wrong. And it was on, she said something to the effect of, she is looking for experiences, not possessions. Mm-hmm. And it had to do with her wanting to not buy things for herself, but to go do things. So I guess you could say, if your goal with retirement, Chris, to borrow from that young 20, I think she was 28 in the article, what that youngin was saying, if you will, if you are looking for experiences, not inheritances, our approach may appeal to you because we're trying to break your money out and tell you how much you can spend safely, or at least right now safely, it can change, so it's got to be monitored all the time, but how much you can spend on experiences. And yes, anything you spend on experiences is that much less in an inheritance. If it's not experiences over inheritances you want, if you want to maximize inheritances at the cost of your own experiences for the last phase of your life, we all know how this ends, folks. No, our approach is not for you. Our approach is to give you experiences over inheritances, but we address it right in the calculation of your fund number. We call it guaranteed inheritance, and we talk with people we're working with. And if you're a do-it-yourselfer, you need to be talking to yourself. How much am I going to peel off from, we call it your preliminary fund number. How much do I take out of this preliminary fund number because I want to leave it to my beneficiaries? And as you do that, what happens, Chris? People see first aid, whoa, that's getting low. Gee, I don't know if I want to leave that much. That means I got to sacrifice. If that's your goal, you could still work with a firm who has a philosophy similar to ours. Again, we've paused right now. We're not unpausing until next year. We paused on retirement planning clients. So if you're working with someone, hopefully they're going to show you, hey, I can put more over here for your guaranteed inheritance. That's less over here for you to spend. That's all it's showing you. So you could still kind of do that, Chris, and then earmark the inheritance money to a very aggressive investment mix. Now, I'm not saying if you have all cash or 70% cash right now like Bill Benjamin did, you're going to throw that into the market today. But we kind of address the inheritance. But Chris is right. It's not our primary goal. We have you pull out what you think you might want to give. But if your answer is, I don't want to spend anything and I want to leave this all to my kids to have fun with, or to a charity or a church or a school or whoever you're going to leave it to, favorite podcast host, then you could either pull it out or, yes, go to a quote-unquote safe withdrawal rate and limit your spending. But I thought that was interesting how the younger generations are looking at experiences over possessions. And she was, the whole point of the article is she was sacrificing what she would spend today on things. She doesn't want possessions. She wants life experiences. So I just kind of thought as you were talking, experiences, not inheritances. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, sounds good.
Perfect.
Well, thanks again, everybody, for sticking with us. The shows get longer and longer every week. And one said to shorten it up, though. So I guess until we hear people complaining that they're getting too long, we'll just keep going.
Well, they can listen at 2, 3, 4 times speed. And right?
I guess so.
Well, we have listeners.
If you do that,
though,
you have to walk at that speed, too. So,
well, I know people listen to it at 1.5 times, which is probably perfect for when you're talking. I don't know how in the hell you can listen to me at times at 1.5 times. But anyways, we do know people do that.
So thanks, everybody. If you have an idea for a future show, send it in. If you have a question for the Q&A show, I like to remind people of that every show in case you're a new listener. The way you submit questions for us to answer on the Q&A show, email directly to Jim, jim@jimhelps.com, or go to our website, jimhelps.com. That's Jim, HELPS.com. On there, there's a contact form, but a direct email works just fine to Jim's email for the most part. He's got a very sophisticated filing system, and it'll never be lost.
No, but never. And remember, yeah. First five Bugsies could find themselves on a special Q&A show.
Votes. Whatever.
First five votes, Bugs or Bugsy. Send them all in with your question. And
Bugs is clearly more appropriate.
You just might make the new question of the week.
Okay. Well, thanks. We'll be back with you next week with a brand new show and maybe the results of the poll.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.